mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Participation trophies, 13th place finisher ribbons, scoreless soccer matches, and it is an honor just to be nominated. In the push for a kinder, gentler society, it seems that everyone's a winner. But while we don't yet know the result of this election day, two things are certain. There will be winners and there will be losers. And that's what today's show is all about. We'll explore winning and losing in the natural world throughout history and how it affects the brain. Dr. Ian Robertson is a neuroscientist and chair in psychology at Trinity College in Dublin, who studies the way the brain responds to winning and losing. He explored that in an extremely popular TED Talk and wrote about his findings in the book The Winner Effect, The Neuroscience of Success and Failure. Ian Robertson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, we're talking to you on a special day here in the U.S. when we determine winners and losers in a very clear fashion. Are the successors and the not-so-successful so clear in the natural world?
Well, to an extent they are, although, you know, one day you can be a winner and the next day you can be a loser. That being said, the game is rather biased because most animals, including humans, create hierarchies, which can be quite stable. And the higher you are up the hierarchy, the more likely it is you are going to win, and vice versa for losers.
Now, what is the most significant factor in determining whether a person is successful or not?
The best predictor of success is previous successes. And that's what the winner effect is. It's true of humans, but it's true of most animal species as well.
Why does the winner effect take shape, and how? In the body or the brain?
Well, unfortunately, we can't delve in the same detail into human brains that we can into animal brains. But when we study animal brains, when they win, you get a surge of testosterone. And that testosterone, this is both females and males, that testosterone increases the number of receiving stations, receptors for testosterone and similar hormones, so that the next time they have a contest and they get a surge of testosterone, that testosterone will have a bigger effect. And what happens to the brain is you get more motivation and more aggression. So the primary mechanism of the winner effect seems to be on motivation and aggression.
And conversely, somebody who has lost previously, they would not get the same rise in testosterone.
They won't have the surge. Even chess players before a contest, male or female, will show an increase in testosterone before the contest. And the bigger that increase in testosterone, the greater the probability is that they will win, all other things being equal. The converse is that if you haven't had the benefit of previous successes, then you won't have benefited from these surges of testosterone, and so you won't get the supercharging of your brain, if you like, that is consequent on success.
So is being a winner, is it always the same as sort of coming in first?
Coming in first, if your motivation is always to be first, that is a pretty precarious kind of motivation to have in life, because there's always in the world someone better than you. And so what having that kind of motivation to be first is sometimes considered to be a less authentic type of motivation. And even though coming first, getting a gold medal at the Olympics, for instance, or getting the Nobel Prize, produces an enormous benefit to you in your brain and your body, there are not many times, and you cannot guarantee always coming first. So a much more stable and healthier source of the winner effect is to set goals for yourself, to have goals which are personal and which are meaningful and which are more authentic. And that means you can create for yourself lots of little winner effects, success experiences, which you can benefit from, even though you may not be top of the tree in terms of objective performance.
Well, and as you said, you can't always win. Losing is built into politics, for example. Politicians lose. So how do they bounce back from that? How do they get that momentum again?
What happens is people who don't have that capacity to pick themselves up after a defeat and to come back, they don't make it through the early stages of politics. There's no politician has not had defeats. And so you're selecting out people with a particular appetite for, particularly for power. And that appetite for power can be enough of a fuel, if you like, to keep you going through the low periods and even the periods of having lost or being defeated.
So the brain chemistry must actually change to keep that going. So the brain chemistry of a politician would be different from, say, a public radio host, for example.
Well, that's an interesting question. And no one's done the study of these particular two people. But what we do know is this. People who have a big appetite for power, who enjoy power, and that's true for most politicians. So what we know about people with a high appetite for power is that when they win, they get a much bigger surge of testosterone. And that has downstream effects on their brain, on the dopamine levels in their brain, for instance. And they benefit from winning more than someone with a lower appetite for power. If they lose, they hate losing because they get a big surge of the hormone cortisol, which is the stress hormone. And that really... Where people, for instance, people with a low appetite for power who don't make good politicians, the people with the extreme end of that spectrum, they actually find winning stressful and they get a surge of cortisol when they win.
It's interesting that you say that, you know, this difference between the stress hormone and the sort of puffed up hormone, because in populist politics here, there's been a lot of talk of the game being rigged, you know, that momentum is behind the wealthy, the well-connected, the successful, in other words. Now, knowing what you know about brain chemistry and biology, is there any truth to that?
I suspect there is a considerable truth to it. There is evidence the steeper the socioeconomic hierarchy, then the greater the benefits for those higher up that hierarchy, and the greater the disadvantages of people lower in the hierarchy. And there have even been studies showing that people lower down the socioeconomic scale have actually lower dopamine levels in their brain. And that actually, lower dopamine levels equates to less capacity for bold action, for taking initiatives, and even reduces, saps mental function to a certain extent. So yes, having the silver spoon in your mouth will definitely make you more liable to be successful. And that is a feature of some societies more than others. It has its upsides and its good sides towards in the line of rewarding enterprise, etc. But it also has its downside in terms of steadily increasing a hierarchy that may exist already.
We're talking about the neuroscience of winners and losers and successes and failures with Ian Robertson. He's author of the book The Winner Effect and also chair in psychology at Trinity College in Dublin. Maybe you've seen his TED Talk on The Winner Effect. We know, you know, a surge of dopamine in the body feels good. Drugs do that, or extreme exercise. Testosterone probably feels good. So does early success in one's life make one hungrier for even more success? Are they sort of chasing that feeling?
Well, that's an interesting question because it depends on what you make of that success. If you are told, for instance, supposing you're a very blessed young man or woman who has every fortune, but you are told you're very clever, you're very bright, you can adapt and create a theory of your own abilities, which is called an entity theory or a fixed theory, which says, well, I am all these wonderful things, not through my own action, but because I was born this way. Now, that is fine so long as you don't hit any adversity. But what happens is if you have a failure experience or you fail an exam or you flunk college or you get rejected by someone, that can leave you with very impoverished resilience, because what that means is if all these attributes are given to you, then if you come up with evidence that you don't have these, if you've just failed, for instance, the conclusion is, oh, maybe I'm not bright, or maybe I'm not attractive, or maybe I'm not successful. Whereas another person who does conceive of their abilities as being part endowed, but also part due to their own efforts and to the environment, they're better able to ride through setbacks or adversity.
I'm thinking about that saying, you know, fake it till you make it. Obviously, your brain chemistry may not be willing to do that. But is there any way that we can sort of pretend, project ourselves as winners to change the results?
So, yes, there are astonishing findings that if you adopt the posture that a powerful person would typically adopt, you know, erect stance, occupying space, maybe hands on your hips, or kind of spread eagle, you know, lounging back in the chair as the CEO might do when interviewing a junior member of the company. That is space-occupying behaviour. In all species, not just humans, that kind of dominance posture, sometimes called a power pose, if you get people to take up such a pose without having any of the mental, the thoughts and the feelings to go with it, but just fake the power pose, you trick the brain into assuming that it is more dominant. And as a result, it secretes more testosterone and it also creates more dopamine in the brain. And dopamine is part of the reward network, which makes you feel in charge. It makes you feel more bold and more confident. And so you can actually, as you said, fake it till you make it by adopting the external trappings of success and dominance. And you can actually, the evidence is, perform better in interviews, for instance, if you behave as if you are not the quaking jelly inside, which you actually feel like.
They say, of course, that winning is not everything. Is that true? Is that all that we care about, is winning, even if we don't think we do?
There's very few people who don't get a thrill at winning. The most secure kind of winning is winning vis-a-vis your own goals, achieving things you've set for yourself. But nevertheless, many people just no one would not feel delighted to be given the Nobel Prize or to get a gold medal at the Olympics. I mean, I guess there are some very enlightened people, religious people who have transcended that and who have escaped from the mortal coil of trying to achieve, but it's there's very, very few of us manage to do this. And the secret is to try and create for ourselves a world we benefit from success experiences. And best way to do that is to have goals for ourselves which are our own goals relative to our own aspirations and not ranking goals vis-a-vis other people, because if you're low down in the social hierarchy, then you're going to continually experience failure experiences, and that's not good for any brain.
Dr. Ian Robertson, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Ian Robertson, neuroscientist and chair in psychology at Trinity College in Dublin. You'll find a link to his book, The Winner Effect, as well as his TED Talk, on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we will continue our exploration of winners and losers in the world of sports, what it takes to win in the boxing ring. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.